In early December, delegates from around the world will sit down to talk climate change at a major UN-sponsored conference in Copenhagen. There will, no doubt, be political wrangling over how to reduce carbon emissions, but away from the politics is the work of climatologists, the people who come up with the models that predict how climate change will unfold. Dennis Wheeler from the University of Sunderland in Britain is one of those climatologists, but he's not only looking at the latest cutting-edge data to map the future of weather. He's reaching back hundreds of years to the logbooks kept by sailors during those early, harrowing naval voyages in the Age of Discovery.
Meteorological journal and sea log of His Majesty's ship, Isabella. Wind direction south, wind force, light airs, temperature 53 degrees, barometric pressure 29.
Dennis Wheeler joins us from the University of Sunderland. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Guy.
Tell me about these logbooks. Where do they come from, and what were they used for?
Well, the vast majority of logbooks we use are the logbooks of ships in the service of the Royal Navy. The Admiralty made it compulsory for all captains, masters and lieutenants, that's to say senior officers on board, to maintain a regular daily logbook of their activities in which they had to describe what was going on board, supplies of food, water taken in, and so on and so forth. But they also were very careful to stipulate that officers had to record the weather.
So they're basically recording temperature and wind speed and barometer pressure and things like that every day?
Well, first of all, from 1680 until about, let's say, 1770, 1780, the first 100 years, we don't have any instruments on board. They were far too valuable and far too complex to put on board something as uncertain as a ship. And for the first 100 years, what we have is useful information on wind force, wind direction, and the general state of the weather. Now, just because it doesn't have numbers doesn't mean it isn't useful for us. In fact, it's extremely useful information. Mm-hmm. But we find that it's very valuably supplemented from about 1780 onwards by the increasing appearance of barometers, that's for measuring air pressure, and thermometers for measuring air and sometimes sea temperatures, which are regularly carried on board by officers of the Royal Navy and by some other ships as well.
And some of these logbooks are from relatively famous journeys, the HMS Beagle, the ship on which Darwin traveled, Captain Cook's boat, the Resolution.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, this particular project that we've just completed is one that is focused specifically on the logbooks of voyages of discovery. You mentioned Darwin already, and he was on board the Beagle for its 3 or 4 year circumnavigation of the globe. And we have Cook as well. These are all skilled scientists, and it's supplemented the normal daily observational routine with much more detailed observations, sometimes taking thermometer readings every hour. And these are amazingly useful for us.
Professor Wheeler, what questions do you hope to answer by looking at this data?
What we need to do is to get a very firm understanding of the degree of natural variation, not only over land, and we understand that fairly clearly now, but we do need to look at the oceans as well. They're so big and they're such an important part of the whole climatic system. And once we've got that clearer picture, what it means is that the people who are engaged in predictions for the future can take their models, the general circulation models, as they're known, the GCMs. These models need to be calibrated, and we can only calibrate them against past conditions. Well, fairly obviously, the more data we have for the past, the more accurate our picture of the past, the better is the calibration on those models. So when we use them to look to the future, we can be just that bit more precise about how temperatures are likely to change over the next 20, 50, or maybe even 100 years.
From these logbooks, are we able to get a sense of how far the polar ice caps have receded and whether there was, you know, more sea ice at the time these journeys were taking place, you know, versus 50 years later or 100 years later or today?
That's right. It's a very good question. The answer is yes, we can. And this is where the non-instrumental data that I mentioned before is so useful, because these ships were careful to record their encounters with icebergs, pack ice and ice that would freeze them up for the winter, because many of them in the Arctic Oceans would be quite prepared to spend a winter up there and engaged usually in a search for the Northwest Passage, the quick route through to the North Pacific Ocean. So we are able to plot very carefully year by year where the ice advanced and how far it retreated. So the summer retreats, the winter advances are dated and they're spatially defined for us. And that's extremely useful data.
Now, the idea is that these logbooks will all be digitized eventually, which will give everybody access to see them. What's it like to handle those old logbooks?
It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, some of the older ones that we use from the less famous voyages, we're aware that when we open those pages, it's probably the first time they've been opened in the 200 years since they were written. Mm-hmm. And that's an absolutely extraordinary and very enriching experience.
Dennis Wheeler is a climate researcher at the University of Sunderland in Britain. Dennis Wheeler, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Diplomats from the U.S. and other rich countries will meet on Sunday in London. They'll be talking about a new global warming agreement. It's becoming clear that the New Deal will not simply be a revised and expanded Kyoto climate treaty. To the consternation of many countries in the developing world, it appears that the Kyoto Protocol will be abandoned. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, it's not clear exactly what will take its place.
The Kyoto Treaty was a landmark when it was negotiated 12 years ago. The key to the pact was that many industrialized countries promised to reach emissions reductions targets on a specific timetable. But what's to come after the treaty's initial term ends in 2012? Evidently not a more ambitious version of the same arrangement. That became apparent during climate talks in Bangkok last week.
We have witnessed one developed country after the other making pronouncement that literally amounts to discarding the Kyoto Protocol.
Lumumba Diaping is a Sudanese diplomat who is speaking on behalf of some 130 developing nations. They are extremely unhappy about this turn of events.
It's like throwing away your baby and saying, no, I will have a new one.
Diaping fretted that it could take yet another 15 years if nations of the world decided to start from scratch on a new mechanism to limit greenhouse gas emissions. European diplomats in Bangkok tried to couch their change of heart about the Kyoto Treaty more delicately, but Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations says the facts are stark.
Kyoto is essentially dead after 2012.
Levy argues that's not actually a bad thing. Disagreements about the Kyoto Treaty have created global deadlock on a climate deal. The United States never ratified the agreement because it doesn't require any action from the developing world, even from China, which is now the world's largest emitter. The Bush administration considered that a fatal flaw, and so does the Obama White House. Jonathan Pershing is a top U.S. negotiator.
The notion that we should have an agreement which looks explicitly and exclusively at a handful of countries doesn't seem right. The whole purpose of this is to move the world to a better place, not to move one set of countries down that road.
American resistance to the Kyoto Treaty created a huge political schism, with Europe and much of the developing world complaining that the United States was dragging its heels on climate change. Other shortcomings of Kyoto simmered quietly in the background, Levy says.
There was widespread agreement for quite a while, I think, that the Kyoto approach was not going to work, but no one wanted to be the one who said that.
Finally, at the climate meeting in Bangkok, European diplomats suggested that they would just let the treaty expire. In an interview with NPR this week, European Commission Vice President Margot Wallström put it in practical terms. It's been a logistical nightmare for the Kyoto signatories to try to update that treaty while at the same time trying to negotiate an additional treaty that the United States would agree to.
If they can be merged, I think we would all be glad. We want to have it in one negotiation track.
The huge question, of course, is what a new treaty would look like. Alden Meyer from the Union of Concerned Scientists says one option on the table is each country would simply pledge what it intends to do rather than negotiate collective targets and timetables.
It's different than a political negotiation where you work something out and you sort of have to hold hands and jump together. Of course, the flaw was in Kyoto, the U.S. wasn't one of the handholders.
Meyer says the worry is countries won't pledge enough action if each one gets to decide for itself how hard to try. And Michael Levy says a new treaty won't come together overnight.
Will it take time to negotiate? Yes. Does it mean we're not going to have a deal this December? Yes. But we weren't going to have a deal under Kyoto this December either.
December is when diplomats meeting in Copenhagen are supposed to have come up with a new climate agreement. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Mexico has deployed its navy to several beaches along the Pacific coast, but the move's got nothing to do with fighting drug cartels or protecting tourists. They're protecting an endangered sea turtle. Olive Ridley turtles were once harvested to the brink of extinction. But as NPR's Jason Bobian reports, the Mexican government has orchestrated a comeback.
This time of year, along a solitary sandy beach in southern Oaxaca, turtles bob in the waves just offshore. And then, based on some signal that's not entirely clear to scientists, the females storm the beach. Well, they sort of waddle out of the surf on their flippers, but they come ashore by the thousands. Erica Peralta Buendia, a biologist with the Mexican government, is standing amid the mass of female turtles.
Practically, la playa se llena.
Practically the whole beach is full, she says. It's 3 or 4 kilometers full of turtles, one right next to another. This is La Escobilla, one of the most important nesting grounds in the world for the olive ridley. The females are gray, weigh about 100 pounds, and their shells are about the size of a tire on a Honda Civic. Prior to 1990, this beach was a slaughter ground for the olive ridley. Sea turtles can't retract their heads into their shells. People would bludgeon them to death and then haul them to Mexico's largest turtle processing plant just up the coast. In 1990, Mexico declared a total ban on killing sea turtles, Peralta says. No one can harvest the turtles or their products. Prior to this, turtle byproducts, the meat, the shells, the skins, the eggs, were the second largest industry for this impoverished region after shrimp. The slaughterhouse used to employ 200 people at the height of the season, but while it was offering jobs, it was decimating the sea turtle population. The Mexican government shut down the plant in 1990 and replaced it with an aquarium called the Mexican Turtle Center.
This is the peak of the season. Yes, we are going probably 100,000 turtles in 3 or 4 days.
Marta Harfush, a biologist at the center, says sea turtles are extremely vulnerable for several reasons. First, they only nest in significant numbers on a few beaches in Mexico, Costa Rica, and India. Second, the turtles are only on land when they're born and when they lay their eggs. Consequently, they're sitting ducks on the beach. Vultures pluck the soft-shelled babies out of the sand soon after they hatch, and a beetle has been destroying their eggshells. And people still covet their meat and eggs. Harfish says turtle fat is sold as a cure for the common cold. Turtle meat is still a traditional meal at some weddings, and their eggs are supposed to have sexual powers.
They use in bars or restaurants for not for food. It's a complement of the beer. That's why, and they say that it's aphrodisiac. That's why many people sell them.
She says the temperature on the beach can also dramatically affect the turtle population. If the sand during the third week of incubation is 30 degrees centigrade, half the hatchlings will be female and half will be male. But if the average temperature rises 2 degrees during that period, all the babies will be females, she says. And if it falls 2 degrees, all the babies will be males. Prior to 1950, an estimated 10 million olive ridley turtles nested each year on Mexico's southern coast. By 1988, just before Mexico banned their harvest, the population had dropped to just 40,000. The National Marine Fisheries Service in the U.S. still categorizes the olive ridleys that breed in the Pacific as endangered, but Harfush says they've rebounded significantly. Now just shy of 1 million olive ridleys nest each year, primarily on 3 beaches in Oaxaca. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has made no secret of its opposition to climate change legislation working its way through Congress. So when the chamber held a news conference this morning announcing a complete reversal, it was big news. But only for about 20 minutes until it became clear that the whole thing was a hoax. NPR's Tamara Keith tells us what happened.
The Chamber of Commerce got punked, and so did Reuters, which went to its newswire with urgent bulletins announcing the chamber's apparent shift. There was a press release, an official-looking website, and a news conference at the National Press Club with this guy behind the podium.
I am Hingo Sembra, official spokesperson for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, so what's your real name?
Okay, I'm Andy Bickelbaum, and I'm with the Yes Men.
The Yes Men are a crew of pranksters who have pulled off similar hoaxes, posing as officials from Exxon, Halliburton, and the federal government. In this case, they were working with a small activist group called the Climate Action Factory. Bickelbaum wore a borrowed black suit. He delivered formal remarks about the chamber's momentous decision, then opened it up to questions. There were about a dozen reporters there.
The questions seemed to all be very banal, like, well, this carbon tax you're talking about, it's not necessarily going to happen. How do you feel about that? You know, what are the next steps? It just seemed perfectly ordinary to everybody.
Perfectly ordinary until a real chamber spokesman showed up.
I'm Eric Wolfschlegel. I'm with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is not an official U.S. Chamber of Commerce event.
In this video, shot by Brandon Jordan and posted on the Yes Men website, the real chamber spokesman and the fake chamber spokesman argue about who's lying.
Can I see your business card?
Can I see yours?
Are you here representing?
The audio is hard to understand, but basically Wolfschlegel is challenging Bickelbaum's credentials, saying it's strange he's never seen him around the chamber before. Now, just to be clear, the chamber has not changed its position on climate change legislation. It says it supports the idea of addressing climate change, just not the bills Congress has come up with. In a statement, the business lobbying group said hoaxes like this one undermine genuine efforts to address climate change. 20 minutes after the first breathless bulletin, Reuters issued a correction. Courtney Dolan with Thomson Reuters says the news service has an obligation to run with stories that could move the financial markets.
Once we confirmed the release was a hoax, we immediately issued a correction. And in keeping with the Reuters policy, the story was subsequently withdrawn and an advisory was sent to readers.
The chamber says it will be asking law enforcement authorities to investigate the hoax. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here, our video producer. Welcome, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
You've got our pick of the week, which is at sciencefriday.com. Our new video pick this week is about
birds.
Birds. We all love birds.
If you didn't get enough bird action last week during our migration blowout, there's more.
There's more.
So we were up in Ithaca last week to do this remote show.
Right.
And as a little field trip, we went out with one of our guests, David Bonter, who works. He's an ornithologist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And he took us to Braddock Bay Bird Observatory, which is this beautiful spot right on Lake Ontario. And it's actually this converted hot dog stand. It used to be a hot dog stand in the 50s, so it really looks like...
It is. Your video shows it. It really does look like they're selling ice cream out a window with it.
And it's kind of keeps its social tradition even to this day, although there are no hot dogs. Now it's filled with birds. Mm-hmm. So we went to this banding station and learned about how this team of volunteers bands the birds and also why the birds love this spot on Lake Ontario.
They fly. That's why the station was put there.
That is why the station is there. It's kind of interesting. So, you know, birds migrate for thousands of miles, but how do they decide to stop in one place over another?
It's not the hot dog stand. That was the
It's the equivalent of the hot dog stand for birds.
That's right.
That's kind of the amazing thing. So they're flying over Lake Ontario. They're coming from the north. They're these little tiny songbirds. So one of the birds we see in the video is a golden-crowned kinglet, which is about the weight of a couple of coins in your pocket, just teeny tiny. And it goes, you know, all the way over across this lake, and it stops here because, first of all, it needs to take a break after going across giant Lake Ontario, but also because it's a really great spot for food. So Bonter, this ornithologist, describes different types of migration stops. So imagine you're on a road trip. There's the, you know, pull off the side of the road rest stop.
Right.
You're desperate. You have to have a coffee. You just have to pull off. Braddock Bay is not this.
Unless you're a bird.
Unless you're a bird, except that it also has all these other amenities. And so he sort of describes it as the full service restaurant of stops.
Wow. We're talking with Flora Lichtman on our video pick of the week this hour on Science Friday from NPR News.
I'm Ira Flatow, suggesting that you surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where the video is up there. And what extra stuff did you have since the last time you put our video up there? What do we see in this video?
That you didn't – yeah, there. This is a two-part series.
Two-part series. The first one was terrific, and those birds are cute.
They remain cute in the second video, too. Well, I think one of the things is seeing what a full-service restaurant looks like for a bird.
Mm.
You know, so it's really a beautiful spot that's worth taking a look at. And then also seeing all of these kind of citizen scientists do really technical things on these birds. Like they take blood and it was pretty amazing.
Now you also are here to tell us about the results of a survey we asked people to help us out, right?
Yes. So going back in a few weeks, we had a video about these researchers who made a tiny river in their lab.
Oh, yeah.
And we asked our audience come up with a better title than what I had come up with, which many people did. I mean, really lots of better titles, but we have our top five.
Now, this was a tiny – imagine if you saw from the air a video of the Mississippi and shrunk it down. This is what they actually made in their 100-foot laboratory, right?
Yeah, so it's just a scaled-down
version. And we need a name for this kind of river. And we asked them, and you came up with your top five. Number five.
Number five, thanks to Greg Good, is the Mini-Me Meandering River.
Mini Meandering River.
So I think this is a takeoff of Mini Me, which if you've seen Austin Powers, you know what I'm talking about. And also meandering, because it's the type of river is meandering river. That's pretty good.
It's pretty good. And Flora is the judge of this. So
it appeals to me. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Number four.
Number four. A river runs through Sprout. And this is thanks to Kip. And the reason why this one is good is because the greenery on this river is alfalfa sprouts.
Oh, yes. I forgot. A river runs through sprout. Oh, okay.
Thanks, Kip. Pretty good.
Okay. Number three.
I really like this one, although it's a little off topic. It's sedimentally yours.
Oh, I get it.
That's right. It's unidentified, the person making this comment, but I think if I were a geologist, I would always sign my email sedimentally yours.
Sedimentally yours. Cool.
Okay. Runner-up for number one, so we're now at number two, is the Rio Smalle.
Just like the river.
Just like the Grande, but Smalle. And here we are, getting ready for number one.
Number one. Wait, we need a There we go. The bell is the number one pick.
Number one pick, and a few people did this. It's in the same vein. It's the Mini-Sippi.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah, it's pretty good, right?
The Mini-Sippi.
The Mississippi.
Is it easier to spell?
I think there's...
You're missing a few S's.
Right.
The Mini-Sippi. And if you want to see our video pick of the week with birds, are we going to put these results up there on our website?
Yeah, you know, I think we will... We'll put the Mississippi up there as number one.
As number one, the winner, and maybe we can send them some old news copy or something.
Yeah, I'm sure they really want that.
They really, you could autograph it and send it out.
I'm sure they can live without that.
Okay, Flora, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman, our video producer with the video pick of the week, and thank you for your help, everybody out there, in choosing that name. That's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata, senior producer at Heist, Charles Berquist, our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our SciArts producer. Shelley Du Bois is our Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director and at the controls here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got that video up there, those cute birds, and them having a good time getting weighed and measured and all kinds of stuff and getting a little bit of food on their long flights. Also, we're Twittering and tweeting and podcasting and everything that we do in our social media on Science Friday. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh has stirred up another controversy with some of his latest comments. He lashed out this week at a New York Times reporter, calling him part of, quote, a radical environmental movement. That reporter is Andrew Rifkin. As NPR's David Folkenflik explains, Rifkin could be considered fairly revolutionary, but perhaps not in the way Limbaugh thinks.
This is what listeners heard Tuesday on Rush Limbaugh's show.
This guy from the New York Times, if he really thinks that humanity is destroying the planet, humanity is destroying the climate, that human beings in their natural existence are going to cause the extinction of life on Earth. Andrew Revkin. Mr. Revkin, why don't you just go kill yourself and help the planet by dying?
For the record, Andrew Revkin has no such plans. His first long article on climate change appeared in Discover magazine 21 years ago, and his coverage now focuses on the question of how the world can grow to its projected population of 9 billion people over the next 40 years with as little damage as possible.
My way is to say, what do we know? What don't we know? What can we learn? What's essentially unknowable? And then what does society do with that body of information that's left?
I spoke with Revkin in the Times newsroom in Midtown Manhattan, but he's been all over the world tracking the effects of climate change, including the North Pole and Greenland, for which he filed online dispatches. That grew into a blog called Dot Earth, now just 2 years old. It's a new role for someone who had been a conventional, though distinguished, print reporter.
It's more like being a mountain guide after an avalanche than being, the old style, here's the news, take it or leave it. Thank you very much. Good night.
Revkin posts his own reporting and links to government documents and scientific journal articles, as well as stories from other news outlets. And he often solicits and publishes the opinions of readers, all the while helping them sift through the flood of information coming their way. Bud Ward is editor of the Yale Forum on Climate Change and the Media. Ward says Revkin is one of the leading reporters in the field.
If Andy's reporting attributes reliability, confidence to a particular set of scientific findings, that certainly has carried a lot of weight within the journalism community generally.
And as Ward points out, that community is shrinking all the time.
Fewer reporters covering fewer stories for a smaller audience in a smaller news hole. It's a tough, tough issue. It's not the kind of issue any general assignment reporter can pick up on day one.
Andrew Revkin says editors have prodded him to write more for the print edition. After all, it has a larger audience and still pays the bills, despite all the growth and promise of the web.
That's been said to me about a year ago, and I've been in print more. But I haven't slowed down on the blog.
Revkin says that productivity comes at a cost.
I've made missteps. I've made probably more mistakes this year in my print stories than I had before, and that's kind of frustrating.
But New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen says Revkin's reporting is greatly enhanced by the feedback he gets from readers and sources online and in plain view.
Those are the kinds of pressures, the pressure to be in the paper regularly, to be on the front page, that have kept traditional reporters from really exploring what the web, the two-way web, the read-write, back-and-forth nature of the web can do for their reporting. One day, all beat reporting will be done this way, but for now, we have to make progress in small steps, and I think Revkin is doing that.
His tone is less formal online, and the sensitive nature of the climate change debate can lead him into controversial areas. Such was the case a few weeks ago at a public forum in Washington, D.C. Revkin spoke long distance by internet video phone, so the audio doesn't reproduce very well. But as he puts it now, he encouraged those in the audience to take part in what he called a thought experiment.
And in this case, I was asking a question about population and carbon. And it got conflated with those who are making strong statements about depopulating the world and that kind of thing.
Specifically, he asked whether families with fewer children should get financial credits for having smaller carbon emissions, as businesses would under some proposed policies. Which leads us back to Rush Limbaugh.
An environmental writer mainstreams an idea floating around the green fringe.
Limbaugh said Revkin was part of a movement to forcibly limit families to a single child, as occurred in China. He also compared the Times reporter to Palestinian suicide bombers. For his part, Andrew Revkin says Limbaugh owes an apology to Revkin's wife and two sons, especially the one who's a regular Limbaugh listener, and who is now, the reporter says, serving in the Israeli military. David Folkenflik, NPR News.